and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the sudden announcement by President Trump that the U.S. is pulling out the 2,000 troops it has in Syria, starting immediately, in a move that was done against the advice of Secretary of Defense Mattis and other top military leaders, which has shocked Republican senators like Lindsey Graham, who are warning Trump he is repeating Obama's alleged mistake of withdrawing from Iraq too early, allowing ISIS to fill the vacuum. But this time, Trump is allowing ISIS to live on and fight another day, just when the Islamic State is all but finished off. Thomas Nichols, a professor of national security affairs in the National Security Affairs Department at the Naval War College, whose latest book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters, joins us to discuss this unbelievable strategic retreat by the U.S. from a tiny military footprint which acts as a tripwire, holding the Assad regime, Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, and Turkey in check. In a recent phone conversation with Erdogan, Trump appears to have given Turkey's autocratic leader, who is threatening to invade northern Syria, permission to go ahead and slaughter the Kurds, who are the only boots on the ground who have helped the U.S.-led coalition rid Iraq and almost all of Syria of the scourge of ISIS, which has now been given a reprieve. We will try to assess why Trump overruled his top military, diplomatic, and national security advisers to essentially reward Putin and the military contractor Raytheon, which now gets to sell Patriot missiles to Turkey. Then we'll examine further this stunning strategic blunder by Trump and Trump alone, in which, in trying to avoid George W. Bush's blunder of getting bogged down in Iraq, Trump is expanding the war and adding to the bloodshed in Syria, making it increasingly likely that Israel and the U.S. are probably going to be sucked deeper into the Syrian quagmire in the future. Nicholas Harris, a fellow at the Center for New American Security working on the Middle East, who served as their 10th First Lieutenant Andrew J. Basevich Jr. USA Fellow, and who is the author of From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition, joins us. Then finally, with Trump, the Trump Organization, and his family now the subject of at least 17 different investigations, we'll examine some of these with Justin Elliott, a reporter at ProPublica, where he covers money and politics and has an article, Trump's Inauguration Paid Trump's Company, with Ivanka in the middle. He joins us to explore Trump's self-dealing, in which the nonprofit set up for his inauguration was overcharged by his hotel in Washington. And just before Florida's Attorney General Pam Biondi dropped Florida's suit against Trump University, her campaign got a $25,000 check from Trump's charity, the Trump Foundation, which New York's Attorney General has just shut down. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Thomas Nichols, a professor of national security affairs in the National Security Affairs Department at the Naval War College. He previously taught international relations at Georgetown University and currently teaches at Harvard's Extension School. And his latest book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Nichols.
Good to be with you, Ian.
And I know that you're not speaking for the Navy, you're speaking for yourself, but what in God's name is going on with President Trump? He's conducting the most important strategic and foreign policy affairs imaginable on this planet, and he's doing it by tweet, and he's doing it against the advice of his top military officers, his Secretary of Defense, his Secretary of State, his National Security Advisor. So what is going on here with this sudden withdrawal of the 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria?
I wish I knew, and I can only speculate. And you can add me to the list of people who are baffled, which is a long list that includes as well Senator Inhofe, who earlier today said, when asked about this, said he had no idea what was going on. He wasn't consulted in advance. The president canceled a meeting with Senator Corker. So there's been absolutely no consultation with Congress about this. There's been no interagency process that anyone can identify. President just seems to have picked up his phone and said, you know, tweeted it out. Here we go. My personal speculation is that he's trying to change the news cycle. This is what the president does when he gets into a tight spot. And, you know, the news has been overwhelmingly bad. We're headed for, and not just in foreign policy. I mean, obviously, the president's personal news is bad. We're headed for the worst December in the stock market since 1931. The North Koreans, you know, are thumbing their nose at us again. The president has been inundated with bad legal news with the Michael Flynn case, not only not getting thrown out of court, which was this ridiculous false narrative that was basically being plumped in conservative media outlets. Not only was Flynn not exonerated, but the judge chewed him out royally, delayed his sentencing yet another 3 months, and you know, speculated about whether he should have been charged with treason. So I think the president decided, well, and again, I have no way of knowing. I mean, I used to be a Kremlinologist. I used to be one of the people that took apart decisions inside the Kremlin as a Russia expert. And now I'm applying those same skills. I'm trying to reason backward from a decision I'm seeing, and I'm trying to assume what happened. So my assumption is, you know, he just decided this is a good way to change the news cycle. It will be popular with the people who were mad at him for sending troops to the border. It shores up again his base, which really seems to be the only political group he actually cares about. But you know, I could be wrong, but there is no other, I can't figure out any other reason to do it other than to manipulate the news cycle and to change on his part what he thinks is to change the rhythm of domestic politics.
And you have to add to the Senate alarm, Senator Lindsey Graham, who said today a lot of us were blindsided. It's Iraq all over again, referring to Obama's decision to pull out of Iraq in 2011, right, which in fact I think was a little bit, it's always been exaggerated because Obama had no choice, because it was actually George W. Bush who had made the deal with the Iraqi government to pull out by that date. But Obama was accused of pulling out early and thus allowing the Islamic State to emerge, or ISIS. And Lindsey Graham went on to say, if Obama had done this, all of us would be furious. If Obama had done this, we'd be going nuts right now. How weak, how dangerous. So this is what I find amazing, Tom, is that there's only 2,000 U.S. troops in Syria. So it's not like we're bogged down in some great quagmire. And these 2,000 troops are, in effect, a tripwire. They're holding in check the Assad regime, the Russians, Hezbollah, Iran, and Turkey. And if you pull out, the Kurds are going to be slaughtered. Hezbollah is going to slaughter the Sunni Syrians. And the war is going to get worse, not better.
Right. 2 points. One is, I don't think Lindsey Graham or anybody else gets points now for suddenly developing, you know, an honesty test about what if Obama had done this. I mean, Graham is absolutely right. And Corker, if you want to throw in, you know, people being honest, even as they're on their way out the door, Corker said that this is worse than what Obama did. And, you know, Graham is right. Republicans would have crucified a Democratic president for doing this. But, you know, it bears repeating that people like Graham, and even to a lesser extent Corker by his inaction, they've enabled this kind of a presidency. They've never really exercised their congressional oversight duties as they've been in the majority. The Democrats have tried and gotten nowhere. And so it's not surprising that the president leaves the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee cooling his heels and then blows off the meeting, because, you know, when has that ever been a problem for him? As to your second point about this just makes things worse, I don't think the president really understands that or cares. I think this is, even for a specialist or even for an attentive president who actually takes the time to read his briefings, it's an immensely complicated problem. But the thing I want to pull out of your comment is absolutely right, that even though it's a small deployment, the United States is kind of the stopper in the bottle that prevents this larger bloodbath, because this is the job of a superpower. This is one of the things that makes a superpower what it is. Our very presence there induces caution on the part of both our enemies and allies alike, that we're kind of, I don't want to say a moderating influence, because we can't moderate how people feel in that region, but we're certainly a restraining influence, because our forces are there. We have to be taken into account. People have to talk to us. They have to understand that, you know, that we're on the ground and we have to be accounted for. When we simply just up and walk out, that sends so many messages that will go beyond just the immediate bloodbath. And that's not to downplay the amount of blood that's about to be shed, but that will reverberate. This is I think there was another senator today who said this is going to make the Obama red line, you know, pale by comparison. I was one of the people very critical of Obama's refusal to enforce his red line. If this policy goes through, this will be worse than the Obama red line. And I would argue that the Obama Syria policy was almost as low as American foreign policy had ever gotten after Vietnam. There's one other point I'd make quickly. I don't know whether this will actually happen or whether it will get slow rolled or, you know, changed or adapted. I don't think the president really cares very much about that either. He said it. His base will believe it. We could probably send five divisions in there tomorrow, and his most loyal voters will say, no, you know, the president took us out of Syria. He kept his promise. And I think that's really all this was meant to achieve. Whether it will happen is going to be a different matter entirely.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Nichols, who's professor of national security affairs in the National Security Affairs Department at the Naval War College. He previously taught at Georgetown University and currently teaches at Harvard's Extension School. And his latest book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. But there was a recent phone conversation that the president had with Turkey's Erdogan. And apparently Erdogan has been openly threatening to invade northern Syria and to wipe out the Kurds, which is his main obsession. And after all, you know, it was Erdogan's regime through their intelligence service, the MIT, that allowed all of these jihadis to come in to Syria and join ISIS, etc. So apparently Erdogan gave Trump assurances that the Turks would finish off the Islamic State, which is ridiculous, because the only people who are finishing off the and have been fighting the Islamic State and are poised to finish them off are the Kurds, and they're just going to be absolutely slaughtered. And my understanding is that the only thing that the U.S. is getting out of this is that Raytheon can now sell Patriot missiles to Turkey.
I still think we're trying to impose too much coherence and agency to a decision that probably didn't take nearly as long to come to as you just took to explain it. I just don't think that this was thought through, and I think the president, for his own reasons, decided to do this. I also think there's not a lot of point, and I don't disagree with you, Ian. I think, you know, your analysis of the situation is spot on, but I don't think there's a lot of point in trying to figure out which bad guy in the world motivated this, because this works in favor of the agenda of so many autocrats that the president admires. It's hard to know which one might have swayed him. I think an Occam's razor approach here suggests, because of the timing, that this may have been motivated more by domestic politics. It's possible that that the Raytheon deal or the phone call from Erdogan or, you know, some kind of body language from the Russians may have induced the president to do this. But, you know, this was such a precipitous and out of nowhere decision that I'm not sure that we can find that much analytical or strategic coherence to it. Personally, I think there's no strategic logic behind this at all. Until I can see evidence otherwise, I think this is part of a pattern in the president's behavior that reacts to terrible news by dropping a big policy decision and sort of, you know, putting the rabbit loose on the racetrack and let the greyhounds chase it for a while.
Well, in agreeing with Erdogan, it's not out of the question that Erdogan, as you know, Thomas Nichols, has been furious at the U.S. for supporting MBS, the Saudi crown prince, in the face of worldwide condemnation of MBS being responsible for the dismemberment of the Saudi journalist with the Washington Post. So it's not inconceivable that if that's the case, then this also gets Turkey off MBS's back. In other words, they...
It allows, again, if there is this much foresight or coherence to this policy, it allows the president to turn to Erdogan and say, here, you know, this smooths over our problem about MBS. I'm not sure that the president's horizon is that broad or that he's thinking that many jumps ahead, because there are simpler reasons to do it, which is that he just happens to like Erdogan. The same reason he kind of likes Putin. And so it could just be that he was swayed by that, because I think the White House, at least, it seems, thinks they've weathered the storm on this MBS problem. I mean, Congress isn't letting it go for once. Congress is actually acting like the Article I branch of government here and demanding some oversight. But I am suspicious of any explanation of a impulsive move by the president that requires too many steps down the analytical chain of foreign policy reasoning. You could almost come up with a good explanation from a White House staffer that would say, look, let's start moving out of Syria and making way so that we can, you know, smooth over our relationship with Turkey. I'm just not sure that that's an argument the president really would understand or act on when there are simpler reasons for him to just drop this. Because, again, there was no interagency process. If there had been a longer process that we could identify here, I think I would be more inclined to say, yes, somebody might have put that on the table. But the fact that you have the State Department, the Defense Department, the Senate, everybody just caught off guard by what seemed to be, you know, again, the president sort of waking up, picking up his phone and saying, it's a week away from Christmas. It's been nothing but bad news. Stock market's in the tank. Michael Flynn's, you know, deeper trouble. What can I do today? And I'm kind of curious about what the proximate cause, you know, as you say, was it a phone call from Erdogan? Was it something he saw on Fox News? Was it, you know, some random conversation in the West Wing? But I'm at this point, I'm still suspicious of any overly complex explanation other than trying to kind of move the focus of the public eye just before the holidays.
Right. But just in closing, Thomas Nichols, this is this massive strategic retreat with a tiny footprint of 2,000 soldiers is a massive gift to Assad, to Hezbollah, and to Putin,
If we pull away from why did Trump do this, and we just look at what the strategic impact of this is going to be, I mean, this is massive. It's enormous. Not just because of the actual presence of the troops and the bloodbath that could well follow, but also because, again, it's a huge step backward from the responsibilities of a superpower. It's a huge abdication of our own responsibility in the world. I think it's telling that the only person who thinks it's a really great idea is Rand Paul, who is, you know, a straight up old school isolationist in the libertarian mode. I think it was Representative Kinzinger today who said he's a libertarian who masquerades as a Republican. And so this is going to embolden America's enemies. It's going to make America's allies doubt us. This is really a significant turning point. If this is not somehow mitigated or stopped, this could be a massive turning point in American foreign policy and not a good one.
Well, Thomas Nichols, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me in.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Nichols, who's a professor of national security affairs in the National Security Affairs Department at the Naval War College. He previously taught at Georgetown University and currently teaches at Harvard's Extension School. And his latest book is The Death of Expertise, The Campaign Against Established Knowledge and Why It Matters. We're going to take a brief station break and be back examining further this stunning strategic blunder by Trump and Trump alone. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nicholas Harris, who's a fellow at the Center for New American Security, working in the Middle East Security Program. He's also a senior analyst at the Jamestown Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based global research and analysis institute. And from 2016 to 2017, Nicholas served as the 10th Andrew J. Basevich Jr. USA Fellow at the Center for a New American Security. And he's the author of From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nicholas Harris.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Nicholas. And the president has caught everybody by surprise. He's infuriated Lindsey Graham, apparently. He's gone against the advice of the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis. He tweeted out today, "We have defeated ISIS in Syria. My only reason for being there during the Trump presidency." And we're talking about a very small number of U.S. forces in Syria, but their very presence is putting the U.S. in an extremely strong position as a checkmate against Russia, Syria, and the Assad regime. So what possible justification, what possible reasoning is there for the U.S. giving up its strategic position in Syria?
President Trump has never been completely satisfied with the U.S. presence in Syria. As much as President Trump likes to say that he wants to kick the crap out of ISIS, he does not want his Iraq war. And by that, he doesn't want a politically controversial U.S. presence in the Middle East that will excite the type of political opposition against him in a future election cycle that George W. Bush got, both in 2004 and then Senator McCain got in 2008. Trump has been very consistent on that since the beginning of his administration. Over the summer, when there was a big policy debate among President Trump's Syria team, he ultimately acquiesced to an indefinite U.S. military presence in Syria with the twin objectives of creating the conditions to have a local partner force that could prevent the reemergence of ISIS and to use the U.S. presence in Syria to diminish Iran's influence. Everyone in Washington thought that when Secretary of Defense Mattis came out publicly and said that the United States will not leave Syria until the objective of preventing ISIS from reemerging was achieved and the irreversible progress in the Geneva process to end the Syrian war had in fact been engaged, that that was it. That when Secretary Mattis said it, no matter what else, that meant it was happening. Well, now we find out that President Trump was quite unconvinced by that logic, and there are credible reports that President Erdogan, in a phone conversation with President Trump last week, promised to purchase U.S. military weapons, Patriot missiles systems, and take the load off of Trump's shoulders of not only the counter-ISIS campaign, but everything that's been going on in Syria.
But my understanding is in the conversation that Erdogan had with Trump, Erdogan also said that his military were poised to invade Syria and knock out the Kurdish forces, the YPG and the Syrian coalition. And this is an extraordinary situation because the U.S. has essentially been protecting the Kurds. The Kurds are the only boots on the ground that have been loyal and helpful to the U.S. in fighting Islamic State, ISIS. They've taken a lot of casualties, and they're just going to get wiped out. So it's almost like President Trump gave Erdogan the permission to massacre the Kurds.
Well, the situation's quite fraught. If you think about it, the Trump team has been thundering to the heavens that it will keep U.S. forces in Syria to reduce Iran's influence, get the diplomatic process moving, and to defeat ISIS. And the SDF, which is the Syrian Democratic Forces Coalition, which has a large component of Kurdish militias, was one of the main mechanisms to achieve these objectives. We'll think about it from this perspective. If you are the SDF, if you are concerned about a Turkish invasion and occupation of your lands, the natural partner you would turn to is, of course, Assad and Russia and Iran. And if you're Turkey, what you want to do is secure your border region. You're not worried about ISIS. There is no Turkish-made security force that's ready to bring security and stability to areas of northern and eastern Syria. That's just the facts. And so the fact is, by making this decision, President Trump is not only undermining the counter-ISIS campaign and therefore creating a lie to his tweet earlier today that ISIS has been defeated thanks to him, it also invites Iran to expand its influence in the Middle East, expand its influence in Syria, and therefore undermine Israel's security, which President Trump himself in recent interviews has said is the main focus of his Middle East policy. Literally, Ian, what President Trump has done today is mayhem-inducing policymaking.
And again, I'm speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, working in the Middle East Security Program. He's also a senior analyst at the Jamestown Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based Global Research and Analysis Institute. And from 2016 to 2017, Nicholas served as the 10th Andrew J. Basevich Jr. USA Fellow at the Center for a New American Security, and is the author of From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition. Well, apparently, in the conversation that Trump had with Erdogan, when Erdogan said his forces were poised to invade, you mentioned and that Trump essentially must have said, well, we're going to get out of the way because that's what they're going to do. The U.S. was a tripwire. It was not only preventing the Russians from taking over the Syrian oil fields on behalf of Assad, it's also astride the route from Tehran into Damascus, so it keeps the Iranians in check. But if the U.S. pulls out, then Turkey's free to move in and slaughter the Kurds, who have been America's allies and the only fighters that have been any help and have taken a lot of casualties. That in itself is incredibly immoral and outrageous. But accepting Erdogan's promises that Turkey will prevent ISIS from re-emerging is ridiculous. Turkey's one of the reasons why ISIS became so powerful, because they created, through the MIT, Turkish intelligence, Erdogan created an underground railroad of fighters coming in from around the world, going into Syria, most of whom joined the Islamic State.
Well, Ian, Turkey has no interest in combating ISIS. Turkey has one interest and one interest only, and President Erdogan has made it very clear. Turkey wants to create a quote-unquote safe zone in the SDF areas east of the Euphrates. Turkey is only concerned about that. Turkey is not concerned about the counter-ISIS campaign. Turkey has yet to confront al-Qaeda and similar organizations like Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, and in fact an ISIS network that's developed in greater Idlib in northwestern Syria. Turkey hasn't even begun that process now. And so the U.S. is supposed to expect Turkey to take on the counter-ISIS mission in eastern Syria. It's ridiculous. I mean, the only way we can explain this is that President Trump really did accept President Erdogan's lie that he was told, and now believes that this is a quick fix way for him not to have to deal with Syria and shifts attention from his domestic challenges. You know, I've heard around town in Washington that, you know, this isn't purely a foreign policy decision, that with all the difficult dynamics regarding President Trump's domestic agenda and some of the questions swirling around the Mueller investigation, that there may also be an element of change in the subject and change in the conversation. And one dynamic that has always played to President Trump's base, and when Trump feels threatened, he always goes to his base. He always goes to the cheers and the adulation he received on the campaign trail, which is he wasn't going to be George W. Bush. He wasn't going to have his Iraq war, and that he wasn't going to be Obama, that he wouldn't let ISIS rise. Well, here's the thing. If President Trump follows this policy decision, no, he won't be like Obama. He would be worse. He would have given ISIS a lifeline.
Well, but this is what Lindsey Graham has just said. He said that Trump is it's worse than Obama, and he's accusing Obama of pulling out of Iraq prematurely and allowing ISIS to form. So Lindsey Graham is making it incredibly clear how he feels. So this is what's totally lacking in the logic, and maybe logic doesn't necessarily apply to President Trump. But his argument, as you've just laid it out, that he doesn't want to get bogged down in Syria like George W. Bush got bogged down in Iraq. The opposite is true. The minute the U.S. pulls out, the Syrian situation will get worse. There'll be more mayhem. And only 2,000 U.S. troops were there preventing further mayhem and allowing the Kurds to extinguish the last of ISIS. Now, when Trump says that ISIS is finished and we have defeated ISIS in Syria, my only reason for being there during the Trump presidency, well, apparently that's not true. I mean, there are allegedly about 2,000 ISIS fighters in the town of Hajin, which is their last redoubt. But a Defense Department inspector general in a report said the number of ISIS fighters in Syria and Iraq is as high as 30,000. So is it possible that Trump is going to do the reverse of what he's promised? Rather than avoid the U.S. getting bogged down in Iraq, the U.S.'s withdrawal will basically remove the tripwire that's preventing further mayhem and preventing ISIS from reestablishing itself.
President Trump's decision has set in motion a whole series of events that will make Syria more unstable and will likely bring the U.S. back into Syria at some future time. Bashar al-Assad does not have the forces to maintain security in the entirety of eastern Syria. He will have to take them from Iran and Iran's Hezbollah network. That will cause further instability in an area of the country that didn't want Assad and where ISIS has seeded a number of its operatives. Whether or not you accept that there are 30,000 ISIS fighters in Syria and Iraq that remain, the fact of the matter is that ISIS has considerable influence over a generation of Syrians that it had tried to indoctrinate during its time that it had caliphate. And Assad just doesn't have the force presence to maintain that. Turkey has neither the operational capability nor the interest to carry out a counter-ISIS campaign in northern eastern Syria. I mean, this decision, you know, the fact that there was a tweet so early in the morning from Trump and the fact that this decision hadn't been properly socialized with the implementers on the ground, the actual U.S. military implementers, seems to indicate that Trump took public an internal debate that he was having with his advisors and is forcefully trying to show that he is the great decider. And what President Trump is actually doing is he's undermining U.S. national security goals. The presence in Syria is the very definition of what the U.S. military prefers, which is light footprint. The U.S. military was building up a local partner force that could take most of the load of providing security and stability. What's being totally lost in this entire discussion is that the United States recently received hundreds of millions of dollars from the United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia for Raqqa stabilization and other stabilization operations. What happens to that? What happens to all the efforts to rebuild Raqqa, which is a destroyed city? Does it stand to die? What happens to all of the internally displaced people? There are hundreds of thousands of internally displaced people in the U.S. zone of control. What happens to them? If Turkey invades, that will create further mass displacement that the Assad government isn't capable of administering to, and neither is Turkey, for that matter. I mean, there are so many humanitarian consequences to President Trump's decision, and the fact that we have good reporting that this decision was not socialized with the very people, including U.S. service members, on the ground in the line of fire is shocking.
Well, but he didn't apparently talk to his special envoy, Ambassador Jeffries, and he didn't. He completely hung out his point man, Brett McKirk, to dry, because it was only, what, a week ago that McKirk said that ISIS is not finished and the U.S. is in there for the long haul?
He's hung out everyone to dry. He's hung out Secretary of Defense Mattis, who said the U.S. will stay until there's irreversible progress in the Geneva process. He's hung out Secretary of State Pompeo, who said the U.S. would stay to counter ISIS and to counter Iran. His National Security Advisor, John Bolton, who said similar things as Pompeo. And perhaps worst of all, his Syria envoy, Ambassador James Jeffrey, who only 2 days ago had come out and defended the administration's policy. All of the things that Trump has done today set all of these people in an awkward position. It makes it seem as if he doesn't actually have a team that can implement Syria policy.
Well, as I say, his point man, Brett McKirk, also in just what only a week ago said nobody's declaring a mission accomplished in Syria. It's just mystifying. And the only person that's going to be cheering this is Assad, Vladimir Putin, and the Ayatollah Khamenei, right? And I understood that the U.S. was even thinking about some military action against Iran. So there's no consistency here. If they really want to take down the Iranian regime, why the hell are they giving it such a gift in Syria?
Everyone is mystified by President Trump's decision-making, most of all the people who work Syria issues for him.
Well, is this a case that he's doing a favor for Putin? I mean, I'm searching here, Nicholas, for some rationale for why he's done this.
No one knows, Ian, and that's the worst part of it. There is no effective way to explain President Trump's decision-making.
So when Erdogan, apparently, after his conversation with Trump on the telephone, said that he'd been given a very positive response. So are we then to assume, and that's a positive response to Erdogan saying that the Turkish military is poised to invade northern Syria and wipe out the Kurds, the YPG, and particularly the SDF, which is the coalition largely run by the Kurds of the U.S.'s 2,000 forces who are being withdrawn. And again, you know, when you talk about America being bogged down, 2,000 American forces in Syria is not a quagmire. I mean, we had, how many do we have in Iraq at the height of the Iraq war?
150,000, Ian.
Yeah. Well, 2,000 is nothing compared to what we had in Iraq. So his logic about not wanting to get bogged down in Syria like George W. Bush got bogged down in Iraq, you know, the numbers just do not support that.
President Trump has no problem with 6,000 to 7,000 U.S. troops in Iraq, but he has a problem with 2,000 troops in Syria.
All right. Well, this is, again, quite mystifying, but really alarming. And I feel for the Kurds. You know, they are extraordinary. They had so many women fighting against ISIS, these dreadful, hateful, misogynistic group of psychotic killers. And Trump ought to visit those graves of all of the Kurdish fighters who've died, fulfilling the U.S. mission, which we're now reversing.
Well, Ian, I'll end on this note. The U.S. has said that its relationship with the SDF has been transactional in nature. If it's true that President Trump sold out the SDF after a phone call with Erdogan, where Erdogan promised to purchase American weapons, then Trump will have put a special emphasis on the transactional nature of that relationship.
Well, Nicholas Harris, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Nicholas Harris, who's a fellow at the Center for a New American Security, working in the Middle East Security Program. He's also a senior analyst at the Jamestown Foundation, a Washington, D.C.-based Global Research and Analysis Institute. And from 2016 to 2017, Nicholas served as the 10th Lieutenant Andrew J. Basevich, Jr., USA Fellow at the Center for a New American Security. And he's the author of From the Bottom Up, A Strategy for U.S. Military Support for Syria's Armed Opposition. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how there are at least 17 different investigations into Trump, the Trump Organization, and his family. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Justin Elliott, a reporter with ProPublica, where he covers money and politics. He has produced stories for The New York Times and National Public Radio, and he's reporting with NPR on the Red Cross-troubled post-earthquake reconstruction efforts in Haiti, won the 2015 Investigative Reporters and Editors Award. And his latest article at ProPublica is Trump's Inauguration Paid Trump's Company with Ivanka in the Middle. Welcome to Background Briefing, Justin Elliott.
Hey, how are you?
Well, thanks, Justin. And right across the board, there's an extraordinary amount of stories hitting us every day about investigations into President Trump, the Trump Organization, and his families. There's a piece by Garrett Graffa in, I think it's in Wired magazine, where he's compiled a list of 17 known investigations into Trump. And, of course, we just learned the other day that the Trump Foundation has been shut down under pressure from the Attorney General of the State of New York. So let's focus on the story that you broke about the inauguration. My understanding is that the money that came into Trump's inauguration was, what, two or three times any previous inauguration?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so there's sort of this abiding mystery at the center of this, which is the Trump Inaugural Committee managed to raise over $100 million and spent the same amount, even though they threw an inauguration that was actually significantly smaller than Obama's, and Obama did it on roughly half the money. They've never given a public accounting of how the money was spent, and so there's still sort of questions about that. What we were able to reveal was that some of the money was spent with Trump's own business, the Trump Organization.
So specifically, I believe Ivanka was in the middle of all that?
That's right. So we published some emails from inside the inaugural committee in which the inaugural committee, which was sort of organizing all the events around Trump's inauguration, was negotiating rates with the Trump Hotel. And Ivanka's on these emails and played some role in these negotiations. And in one of the emails, one of the inaugural planners says expresses concern that the rate they're being charged is way over what they felt they should have been charged. Ivanka's on those emails, and that could actually run afoul of tax laws.
Because she's a White House staffer?
Yeah, there's basically rules for nonprofits around self-dealing. So in this case, according to a tax lawyer I spoke to, because Donald Trump is both the owner of this private business, the Trump Hotel, and also an influential person within this nonprofit, the inaugural committee, the hotel is not allowed to overcharge this nonprofit, which is supposed to be operating for the public good, not for his own sort of personal benefit. So if the IRS audited this the inaugural committee and found that they were overcharged by the Trump Hotel, there could be all kinds of fines. They have to give the money back. And so obviously we don't know if that's going to happen, but good.
Well, it looks as though a lot of foreign governments have been trying to curry favor with Trump by spending a lot of money in his hotels, the Saudis in particular, MBS, who's obviously somebody that's been in the news a lot lately because of the murder and dismemberment of a Saudi dissident at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, and Trump alone has come to his defense when everybody else seems to accept the obvious that MBS was behind the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And then, of course, you've got the crooked, ousted leader of Malaysia last year visiting the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., and running up a huge bill. The very, very right-wing governor of Maine also ran up substantial bills staying in the hotel. I believe, isn't it the state of Maryland that's suing via the Emoluments Clause over this kind of activity?
Yeah, I mean, all of this really stems from Trump's decision not to divest his assets. So, I mean, what the ethic experts normally advise government officials to do is, if you own a business, basically to sell it or at least put it in the hands of somebody that, you know, basically to stop running it. In this case, because Trump has this hotel that's, you know, right down the street from the White House, and he still owns it, the money's still going to him. He's claimed that he is no longer involved in the day-to-day operations, although there's some reason to doubt that. You know, for the last 2 years and you know, stretching back to the transition period before he was even actually president, you've had all of these, you know, potential conflicts of interest come up, starting with, you know, at least in our story, the inaugural committee itself spending money there, and then, you know, then he becomes president, and you have all these foreign governments and American lobbyists and trade associations renting out rooms there, all, you know, apparently trying to curry favor with the powerful government official.
And again, I'm speaking with Justin Elliott, who is a reporter with ProPublica, where he covers money and politics. He has produced stories for The New York Times and National Public Radio, and he's reporting with NPR on the Red Cross-troubled post-earthquake reconstruction efforts in Haiti, won the 2015 Investigative Reporters and Editors Award. And his latest article at ProPublica is Trump's Inauguration Paid Trump's Company with Ivanka in the Middle. Now, I recall a lot of money was out of this inauguration kind of slush fund, which was a record amount, you said 100 million, right?
Yeah, I believe they raised about 105, actually.
105. And that was all spent, but nobody quite knows what it was spent on. Didn't some of that money go to some obscure woman out here in California who's an event planner that apparently she knew Melania Trump?
Yeah, so there's the woman you're talking about, her name is Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, and she's an event planner. I think she actually may be based in New York. She's organized some fashion and sort of celebrity events here in New York City. And on the inaugural committee's tax filing that's public, her company is identified as the highest paid independent contractor getting about $26 million. But that number is actually kind of misleading, because our understanding is that a lot of that $26 million was in turn paid to a series of subcontractors. So it's not really clear what we can take from that. And in fact, when it first came out, people made, the press made a lot of the fact that she was a friend of Melania seemed to be profiting. And that may be true to some extent, but actually in the emails that we obtained and published, Stephanie Wolkoff is the one expressing concern about the rates that the Trump Hotel is proposing to charge. And she actually says in the email something to the effect of, this is not going to look good when it becomes public.
Well, she got that right. But a lot of it, though, it seems to be incredible in terms of self-dealing across the various areas of the Trump organization and the Trump family that are now under investigation. For example, the New York Attorney General, Barbara Underwood, her pressure obviously led to, I think, did she shut down the Trump charity, or did the Trump people shut it down?
Just this week, my understanding is the Trump Foundation agreed to wind down and go out of existence. As part of, I'm not sure if it was technically a settlement, but as a result of this continuing New York Attorney General investigation.
So there's an example there of sort of self-dealing. For example, Pam Biondi, the Attorney General of Florida, Trump gave her a $25,000 campaign contribution from this foundation, which violates IRS rules. You know, you can't give campaign contributions from a nonprofit charity. But the purpose of giving this money to Pam Biondi, the AG of Florida, appears to have been that shortly thereafter she got the $25,000, the Attorney General's office in Florida withdrew from a lawsuit against Trump University. So it's a bit of a coincidence.
Right. I mean, the New York Attorney General has published extensive evidence that the Trump Foundation was operating, pretty much just for the benefit of the Trump family and their business, not for any kind of public good. It was going around this week, I believe this was uncovered by the New York AG, that back in the 1980s, the Trump Foundation had paid $7 to the Boy Scouts of America, apparently to register Donald Trump Jr. As a Boy Scout. So there apparently was no amount of money too small to pay out of this foundation that was supposedly for charitable purposes rather than his own checking account.
So the biggest donors to the inauguration, from what I can follow here, is, and the person who chaired it is a friend of Trump's, Tom Barak, who's connected to Middle East regimes like the Saudis and the Emiratis. Two of the biggest donors, apparently, were the casino magnate Sheldon Adelson and AT&T. Have they complained at all? What did they get out of it?
Yeah, but it's a good question. I mean, to be fair to Trump, these inaugural committees are always a opportunity for big donors, both wealthy individuals and corporations, to curry favor with the incoming president. What's new here is that normally the incoming president doesn't own a business that's getting money from the inaugural committee. To answer your question, none of the donors, as far as I know, have expressed concern about what's going on here. But there is an unresolved issue with the donors, which is this question of foreign donors. It turns out that the inaugural committee is not allowed to take foreign money. And there was actually another guilty plea earlier this year where an American lobbyist pleaded guilty to funneling money from a Ukrainian oligarch to the inaugural, a small amount of money, $50,000, in order to get tickets. And there's some reporting that the new investigation of the inaugural is potentially looking for more examples of foreign money making its way into the inaugural committee. Unclear how that would have happened or who it would have been through, but that is an area that apparently is under investigation.
And you say $50,000 is a small amount of money.
a lot of
Americans can live for a couple of years on that.
Yeah, I mean, compared to Sheldon Adelson, who gave $5 million to the inaugural, it's a relatively small amount.
But is there any evidence that because Tom Barak is so tight with these regimes in Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis, that any Middle Eastern money made its way in?
There's no evidence of that at this point, but there's a lot we don't know about it. I mean, there is a list of public donors to the inaugural, but, you know, in this case earlier this year, a guy gave money, $50,000, to the inaugural, but it turned out it was somebody else's $50,000. They call that a straw donor in the sort of parlance of this world. So whether there are other straw donors in this, you know, pretty lengthy list of people that gave the 100+ million, we don't know at this point. There's no evidence of it at this point, but that is reportedly one of the things that prosecutors are looking at.
And prosecutors have, Mueller's people have talked to Tom Barak, have they not?
Yeah, so it was also reported earlier this year that Mueller's, the special counsel, or his people, interviewed Tom Barak. Apparently the inaugural came up, but, you know, Barak was also very involved in the 2016 campaign as a fundraiser and supporter and friend of Trump. He's also, as you mentioned, a guy who does a lot of business abroad and in the Gulf. We don't know a lot of details about what that conversation was about. It could have been about multiple things, but he has talked to them.
Right. Well, Gates obviously has talked a lot, at least we assume he has. So Mueller must know a lot about what happened to these inaugural funds. But, I mean, the people that were running the RNC through the Trump campaign and into the presidency, they both had to step down. The casino owner, Steve Wynn, and this guy, Elliot Broidy, who's paid off a woman with whom he supposedly made pregnant. There's some suspicious about who actually was the father of that child, and he got some photo. He got some photo op with Trump as a result of this payoff, and was able to make money out of the Middle East. So you keep coming back to it, as much as in the Mueller inquiry, as somebody said, you know, you shake a tree and a Russian falls out of it. As far as what Mueller's doing, it's also true that if you shake a tree, somebody from the Middle East tends to fall out of it too.
Yeah, I mean, just listening to the list of names you're rattling off there, it's kind of remarkable when you step back and look at it. I mean, there's all these investigations. It's hard, even looking at this full time, it's hard to keep track of all of them. But when you think about all of the figures around Trump who've either been prosecuted or are in jail or headed to prison or have stepped down because they've been disgraced for one reason or another, it's a pretty remarkable list. I mean, you have Paul Manafort currently in jail, presumably headed for prison. Michael Cohen, Trump's personal lawyer, apparently headed for prison. Steve Wynn, as you noted, who was a high up RNC official and Trump donor, resigned after a serious sexual harassment allegations came out. Elliot Broidy resigned in the scandal you just mentioned. Rick Gates also apparently headed to prison. I mean, it's really, it's hard to think of a time in sort of recent political history when you've had so many people close to the president who've either been prosecuted or had to sort of step away from public life in scandal.
And it's possible in the not-too-distant future that some people even closer to Trump, members of his family, Don Jr., Jared, Ivanka, they may well, whether or not they head to prison, but they may well be in trouble. So I thank you for joining us, Justin Elliott.
Thanks so much.
And again, I mean, speak with Justin Elliott, who's a reporter with ProPublica, where he covers money and politics. He's produced stories for The New York Times and National Public Radio, and he's reporting with NPR on the Red Cross's troubled post-earthquake reconstruction efforts in Haiti, won the 2015 Investigative Reporters and Editors Award. And his latest article at ProPublica is Trump's Inauguration Paid Trump's Company with Ivanka in the Middle. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.